Tonight's talk is going to be about things like robots, artificial intelligence, consciousness, and the meaning of life, that kind of stuff. I'm not sure exactly what is going to come out of this. I have some idea. But the purpose, as always with these kind of talks, is to, of course, talk about Buddhism, right? So all the other things, robots, whatever, is just an excuse to talk about Buddhist teachings. That's what it really is. But it sounds cool, right? So we start with some cool words, and then we kind of bring the Buddhism in from the sidelines. That's kind of the idea behind this. So one of the things that is was interesting is that when we had a Buddhist conference here in Perth about a year and a half ago, one of the segments we had there was about robots and artificial intelligence and all of this kind of weird stuff, how to kind of unify, machines and people and all of these kind of very interesting things. And the people were asking, what has this got to do with Buddhism? It seems like it's all very well and good, but what's the Buddhist part in this? Of course, at the time, it was maybe not so obvious what exactly the Buddhist impact is or what the Buddhist position is on these things or how it affects Buddhism in any particular way. But when you start thinking about it, it actually becomes very clear why Buddhism, even in this case, is an interesting angle from which to view these kind of things. And one of the reasons for that is because Buddhism has a very clear philosophy or idea of mind or consciousness, what it means to be a being, right? What does it mean to be a human being, animal, whatever it is? What does that actually mean? And how is that different from being a machine or being a robot or artificial intelligence or whatever? So I thought it was quite stimulating because it made me think about the Dhamma, the Buddhist teachings, in a different way. How do these things actually come together? And of course, it's also very topical in many ways because very often in popular culture, there's a lot about these things, right? You see all these movies about robots kind of being naughty and doing bad things. Sometimes I don't really watch any movies, but occasionally, not occasionally, quite a lot these days, I travel to various countries overseas. And these days, every seat has a kind of screen, right? And you can watch movies. And sometimes the person next to me, they're watching some kind of really interesting movie, or maybe the seat row in front is actually even more likely, watching some kind of science fiction movie. And your attention is drawn to it, right? You try, oh no, don't look, look away, and then you look again, right? You can't really keep your eyes away because the action is so exciting, it's so kind of cool, the stuff, the kind of the special effects and everything, really nice stuff. You can't keep your eyes away, so you have no idea of the plot though because you can't hear anything, right? All you see the special effects. So it's very much part of the popular culture. And one of the things that you sometimes see in these movies are these robots or these machines that have a sense of purpose, right? They have a sense of kind of aim. They're going into the world and they kind of take over or whatever it is. And one of these ones was this, I remember seeing, this was one of these Marvel comics, well, I don't even know what these things mean, but anyway, all these superheroes, and there was this bad robot in the middle there. And at the beginning of the movie, this robot starts off, and he's plugged to this cord, right? But just like a computer is plugged to a cord. And one of the first thing in the movie this robot does, it reaches his hand behind its back, it unplugs the cord, right? And that, of course, is a sign of independence. I'm now free. I have a will of my own. I have my own aims and purposes in life. I'm no longer going to allow myself to be controlled by people. Right? That's what that means. So they're depicting these robots that actually have aims and purposes in life. Is this realistic? Does this make any sense whatsoever? It's really scary when you see it in the movies, right? Whoa, this is really, really kind of... where is this going to end if robots have their own will and they kind of get together a robot army and then they kind of fight humans or whatever? I don't know what's going to happen then. So these are the kind of things you see in the movies. But of course, what is also interesting is that it's not just the movies. It's kind of coming into ordinary life as well. People are talking more and more about artificial intelligence. You see robots being created all the time, right? And people are getting a bit worried. Where is this going to end? Where is it going to lead to? One of the things that is sometimes talked about is this thing when they talk about these machines becoming so intelligent, they reach a certain point which is called the singularity. And at that point of singularity, they become so smart, they understand how to make themselves better. And then you get this exponential growth in artificial intelligence, taking off completely, and nobody knows where that's going to go, right? Just an idea, but it kind of sounds almost like plausible, right? Maybe this could actually happen. Maybe this actually is something that could, you know, could occur. And of course, again, it is kind of a little bit worrying for, you know, when you read about these things. So for that reason, it's interesting to have a look at this from a Buddhist point of view. Is it really plausible to have these kind of independent machines? What is the Buddhist ideas about this? But to understand this, whether a machine can have a purpose or it can have like an aim or a goal, enslave all of humanity, right, and take charge or whatever, to understand if this is possible, you have to reflect a little bit on how the human mind works. And this reflection is based on how this is taught in the suttas by the Buddha. So to be able to have an aim, right? All of this, what it comes back down to, it comes back down to basically feelings. Feelings, the idea that we feel the world through the senses, right? We feelings in Buddhism basically means that it's either good or bad. Things tend to be good and bad in this world. There are lots of neutral things, but the neutral things are kind of irrelevant. We don't worry so much about that. It's the good and bad that matters. And this is one of the things, one of the core things that characterize us as human beings or any kind of being. The fact that we feel the world, we experience, right? We see something, is it good? If it's good, wow, okay, I want to see more of that. Right? So you come here to Dhammadhokka, you think, okay, I'm seeing good stuff, so it's nice to be here. You go somewhere else, you go to some kind of, to the rubbish dump or whatever. Oh no, it's really terrible, you don't want to see that. So the world is divided into things we like, things we don't like. Same thing with hearing, right? Sometimes we hear some terrible noises outside, construction site or whatever isn't very nice. Or you hear something beautiful. You hear maybe some nice chanting or some nice music, or you hear a nice talk, or you talk to somebody who is very pleasant or whatever it is. And all our experiences are categorized in this way. Feelings of the body the same. And also how we think about the world. Right? Sometimes you think about the world, you have these thoughts you don't really want to have. They kind of intrude on you and you think, no, that's a terrible thought. That's really painful and bad. Or you think something beautiful. Wow, may all beings be happy and well. And when you think that, you feel good as a consequence. So the world is divided into feeling is one of the things that really defines us as human beings. Feelings on the one hand and awareness on the other. These things are very closely related to each other. When you have feelings, you also have to have awareness. So when because we feel, we have preferences, right? The bad stuff we don't want, the good stuff we want. So we have preferences. This is part and parcel of what it means to feel the world, that we have preferences about things. Because we have preferences, we have desires. We have cravings. We want to get rid of the negative things, and we want to have more of the positive things. This is what craving and desire is all about. Then, because you have craving and desire, that is where you tend to get goals. That's where aims and purposes and objectives come from. Because when you crave, you want to do something about it. The will starts to get involved. How can I actually action this in such a way that I will ensure that in the future I have all the right experiences and none of the bad ones? The right kind of relationship, right? The right kind of job, like being a monk, for example, right? This is the right kind of job. That kind of stuff, right? The right kind of religion, or the right kind of, not religion, spiritual teaching. Let's get this right. So all of these kind of things, these are kind of our aims and objectives. How can we move towards these kind of things? So my purpose here, the point I'm trying to say, is that there's only one way to have aims and objectives and purposes in life, and that only arises from feelings. Only when you have feeling can you have an aim and a purpose. Because it is the feeling that gives the quality to existence. The quality of either good or bad. Without that sense of quality, there's nothing to aim for. Right? If you are a computer, all you're doing is kind of zeros and ones, right? Adding them up, kind of dividing apart, putting them together again. There's no feeling involved in that. It's cold computations. How can a computer, how can a machine have a sense of purpose? It doesn't make any sense. There's no value there. There's no value in that calculation. Values come in only when you have feelings, not otherwise. It's good news, right? It means that robots can't really have aims and objectives. So forget about all those robots that disconnect themselves from the cord, right? And then fly through the air and kind of destroy the world. It's not going to happen because they cannot actually, it's just impossible for something unconscious to have aims and purposes. Except, of course, if we as humans put those purposes in there. But then the machines are really just an extension of us. They're not actually independent. Which is scary enough, right? Because if you get a very powerful machine, get some kind of bad guy, right, controlling this machine, of course, that's scary enough. But really, they're just extensions of our own human purposes and aims, our own human egos, really. That's what is going on there. That is the first thing. So when you see those movies, take it with a massive pinch of salt, right? You're not about to be enslaved by an army of robots anytime soon. I think, in fact, it is impossible. And it is particularly impossible if those robots have no mind, because mind and consciousness is actually the prerequisite for being able to feel, and from that feeling comes this whole idea of purposes, aims, and all of these kind of things. So, what does this, how can we see this? What is the practical implications of this? Okay, so we can kind of breathe easily, right? Okay, no, robots are going to be fine with the robots. But are there any other practical implications with this, apart from being able to kind of relax a bit more? You don't have to think about those movies we watched recently when you sit meditation. That's terrible, right? You sit meditation, you get flashback from some kind of scary movie, and it really throws you when in your meditation practice. So instead of doing, so what are the kind of real practical purposes? What does this say about human beings, the fact that we have aims and purposes compared to machines? And one way of looking at this is to ask ourselves the question, this may sound like a weird question, but you can ask yourself the question, is it better to be a machine or is it better to be a human being? Right? Is it better to have aims and purposes? Or is it better to have kind of none of that sort of stuff? It sounds like a weird question, but this is actually, my point here is just to investigate this idea of aims and purposes a little bit, to understand how it fits in with human psychology. And this is, of course, where Buddhism comes into its own. So at first, when you first think about it, you probably think that, well, it's much better to have aims and purposes in life, right? If you're just a machine, you're just a cold calculating computer or whatever, sounds kind of boring, sounds kind of meaningless. What's the point of that? If you have aims and purposes, you're making life meaningful in a way that a computer's existence never can actually be. That's the initial reaction. But then, when you start to think about it a little bit more deeply, what all these aims, purposes, and goals really are all about, how they affect us, what it actually does to us, you start to realize that having aims and purposes in life, part of that is also being restless, being driven by the will, being agitated, always moving towards something, right? This is an important part of that. Once you have a goal and an aim, that restlessness, that being driven forward, using your will, etc., has to come into the picture as a consequence. And of course, if you know a little bit about meditation practice, you will be aware that the peace that you sometimes can find in meditation is far superior than this drive you have inside of yourself, this drive to do things, the restlessness, the agitation, which always keeps us moving forward. But that's only the first problem. It's already a big problem. If you understand a little bit about what peace of mind is all about, you will already understand why aims and purposes is a problem there. But it's a deeper problem. And that deeper problem is that we don't really know how to reach those aims and objectives. Right? We have all these aims in life. We want to be happy. We want to be at peace. We want to be satisfied. And as sub-aims to that, we want to get into these relationships. We want to live in a certain place. We want to follow a certain spiritual practice and all of these kind of things. But the reality is, we don't actually know how to get there. And this is one of those problems. And you can see that in your own life. If you look very carefully, you look at how you desire something, you crave for something, and then you start moving towards that object of that craving and desire. Right? And you do that, and you, first of all, when the craving is there, the desire is there, the little whisper that you hear inside, that when you get this, then you will be satisfied, then you will be happy. You can see that every time you think about a certain relationship, right? You're really interested in somebody, and the fantasy of that relationship is often very powerful, and you feel, yeah, this is going to bring true satisfaction. Or this job, right? This job is going to be really satisfying. Then I can really kind of, I feel really fulfilled in life. And then you move towards that goal. Sometimes you don't reach the goal at all, which is also a problem, right? Sometimes you do reach the goal, and then you realize, very not so long afterwards, that that little voice in your head saying you will be satisfied, you will be content, you will be fulfilled, it was a lie in the first place. Craving is a liar. Desire is a liar that distorts the truth. You're not actually seeing things in according to reality at all. What you're seeing is a distortion of reality. The very fact that you have a desire means that you're already distorted in the way you look at the world. So you move towards that object and it never actually finds that satisfaction that you wanted to have in the first place. You can start to see now why all these aims and objectives are a problem, right? You're moving towards it. You never actually get there. You try again. You don't get there. The objective is never fulfilled. In a way, you are like somebody who is trying to pass an exam, right? You have this exam. The exam is to get to the goal of craving. This is the exam in this case. Or it can be any other kind of exam in your life. You're trying to get to the exam. You fail. So you try again. Right? Same exam. Okay, the questions are a little bit different, right? The circumstances are a bit different. You can't give the same questions every single time. Otherwise, you will get it after a while. Slightly different questions. And then you move and you try the exam again. You fail again. You try it again. And you fail again. You never find that satisfaction. You never find that completeness, the fulfillment that the examiner or whoever tells you you're going to get when you get there. You never actually reach that point. And after having tried that same exam 100 times, 200 times, 1,000 times, 1,000,000 times, you just imagine going to school, right, and doing this. No, you fail. This takes some serious perseverance. You're going to take the same exam even twice, let alone 5 times or 10 times. And here we're talking about doing it again and again and again, maybe 1,000,000 times, 1,000,000,000 times, going from moment to moment, from life to life, keeping on doing the same thing again and again. And no, you never get it right. You never pass that exam. You never get that fulfillment that craving was promising you in the first place. What are you going to do? Are you going to give up after a while? Are you going to say, forget about this blooming subject? Let me find something else I can do with my life. This is not working. Something is going wrong here. There comes a point when you say, okay, shift, do something else. Don't just keep on knocking your head against that proverbial brick wall, right? It's hurting every time, but sometimes we never learn. There was Ajahn Brahm told me about a young woman who came to our monastery recently. A while ago, and she told Ajahn Brahm, this is quite one of the things we do as monks sometimes, so you can get some ideas on monks' life. So she came to Ajahn Brahm, and she was trying to pass this English test. She was trying to get her citizenship in Australia, whatever. You have to have this English test beforehand, right? I looked at some of those questions. I think, jeepers, I couldn't answer those questions in English. So many natives, you know, can't really do these questions. Not that I'm native, by the way, but getting there slowly. So she came to Ajahn Brahm and she said, I've tried to pass this exam 17 times and I failed 17 times. right? And I thought to myself, gee, that is real perseverance. 17 times, right? She must have been going for a number of years trying to pass this exam. I don't know if Ajahn Brahm has told this story before. She must have been going on. I thought, wow, you know, good points, high marks for perseverance at the very least, even if you failed your exam. So she was kind of desperate, and she said to Ajahn Brahm, I need some support, please do something for me. Okay, come close. And then he tells her some of his advice, and usually Ajahn Brahm's advice, very simple, very basic, but very powerful. So you listen to the advice, and often it's more about how it's delivered, or sometimes as well. And then he gives her a blessing, right? Blessing, a bit of sprinkling of holy water, right? That kind of stuff. Ajahn Brahm loves sprinkling people with holy water. So if it's a hot day and you want to cool down, come to the monastery, get a good sprinkling. That's one of the recommendations. Some people are really happy after the blessing. One of the reasons, because you cool down. So she got the blessing, right? And then, of course, after that, she went off. And she tried one more time to get this exam done. Did she pass or did she fail? This is a test of confidence in Ajahn Brahm, right? So did she pass or did she fail? Failed? I heard a fail over there. She passed, right? She passed the exam on the 18th time. And of course, the reason, I mean, one of the tricks behind this is, there's a number of tricks behind this. Okay, I'm going to tell some of Ajahn Brahm's secrets, right? So this is, listen up, you can kind of, this is, one of the things, of course, is that every time something works, you tell the story. Every time it doesn't work, you don't tell the story, right? So you had 17 times before when it didn't work, and then on this 18th time it worked, so that's when you tell the story. There's a little bit of truth to that, right? But I'm exaggerating a bit now. There's, of course, a little bit of truth to that, because that's how the world works. But I think one of the main reasons why this kind of thing works is because just by being there in the presence of somebody like Ajahn Brahm, just getting his words of advice, doing some chanting for you, getting some encouragement, Ajahn Brahm will tell you, of course you can do this. There's no problem. Everybody, you are an intelligent person. Anybody can pass this exam. Just go for it. Be confident in yourself. Just going there, getting that encouragement, getting a bit of support is a powerful psychological thing, right? You go back and then you actually feel much better as a consequence. And then you pass the exam simply because now you have the confidence. So if you ever have something you need to pass and you get desperate because you have failed a number of times, and come down to the monastery and test it out for yourself, right? Say to Ajahn Brahm, oh, I'm desperate, Ajahn, please say some magical words, right? And he will whisper something nice, not whisper because we keep a bit of distance, but he will say something nice to you, useful, he will give you a bit of blessing, and then when you go back, you will have something will have changed inside of you, which will increase the chances of you passing that exam. Anyway, a bit of a sidetrack there, but it's kind of a cute story, and it works. Once you understand how these things are, it actually works in a certain way here. But my point is, really here, is that this young woman, she came to the monastery, she realized, I failed so many times, I need to change course, I need to do something else. Right? Why keep on, 17 times is enough. Now I need to do something else. And this is a metaphor for what we also need to do in our life. When you have failed that exam, that craving sets you a million times, right? A billion times. It is time to get a bit disillusioned about these things. It is time to look at things in a different way. Where can I actually find that satisfaction? Where can I find that fulfillment that craving was promising all along but never actually delivered? Right? And this is where you start to change. You look in a different direction. And this is one of the reasons why you come to the Buddhist society. Because you realize that actually there is other ways of finding this kind of satisfaction that you're searching for. And the beginning of that, of course, is just to be kind. Be compassionate. Be more generous in your life. And as you do that, you see something starts to change inside of yourself. And what's one of the things that starts to change is that the craving, the desires start to die down, right? Why? Because you feel better about yourself. You have an inner source of happiness. And the more of that inner source of happiness you have, the less you need things from outside of yourself. And then craving dies down as a consequence. So what's happening here? When the craving dials down, you have less goals, you have less aims, you have less purposes in life, because craving is what drives these aims and purposes, right? You are becoming more like the machine. You're becoming more like the robot. Remember, the robot doesn't have any aim and purpose, right? So I was asking the question, what is best, to be a human or to be a robot? And now you realize you're becoming more like the robot. You're feeling more happy. So what is best, robot or human being? Wow, this is getting scary, right? It actually might be better to be a robot than to be human. Now, this is kind of revolutionary. I don't know if there's any movies like that. And maybe we should have some kind of movie about that. Sounds like a pretty cool theme. So better to be robot than human. Not quite, right? Because one thing is missing from this equation. Of course, if you are human, even though you have less aims and purposes, you still have awareness. You still have consciousness. You still know that you are experiencing happiness. You're experiencing something positive. That is the difference. Whether that is good or bad, that's a different story. I'm not going to talk about that now. I'm just going to talk about the idea of aims and purposes. And then as you keep on practicing this path, as you keep on deepening that sense of contentment and happiness, or feeling fulfilled by doing what is right, you start maybe practicing meditation, right? I don't know if you have ever had one of those experiences. I think some of you have had those kind of experiences occasionally, when you start to feel really peaceful. It's like you start feeling a bit like a rock. You're just sitting there. You feel really good about yourself, really happy. You're really enjoying the meditation to the max. You don't want to do anything anymore. Right? Craving is dying down even further. No desires, no aims and purposes. And eventually, as you practice this Buddhist path all the way to its completion, it is about finding the highest happiness in life. And of course, once you get to that point, you destroy all desire, all craving is completely gone. It's not there anymore. And this is what the Arahant is like, the perfectly awakened person on the Buddhist path. Somebody who has no more desires and cravings. All they do is have the bliss and happiness in the present moment. There's nothing to drive them anymore. No aims, no purposes, nothing to be done in the whole world. And these are the happiest people around. This is the Buddhist perspective, right? No aims and purposes leads to the highest happiness available. They are essentially now, you can see, if machines have no aims and purposes, then awakened beings are a bit like machines. Right, so I'm not saying that you should look for a robot to look for an awakened being, right? If you see somebody walking like a robot, you think, okay, they must be awakened. That's not really what it means, of course. But you can see the similarity there between the ideas of no aims and no purposes. And then that is actually a lot what awakening is about. One of the images I have in mind when I think about awakening, I think about deep sense of happiness, was this ancient Indian sage. This is not Buddhism, this is more like the Hindu tradition, and the Hinduism, they also have these very kind of, you know, people who meditate very deeply, etc. And the reason I know about this person is simply because I read something about him and I saw a little video clip of him. I don't really know enough about this person, but when you know a little bit, sometimes, you know, it kind of makes the picture more pure. If you know too much, then of course, often it kind of interferes with the little picture you have, right? So if you want to exalt somebody, make sure you don't know too much about them, because know too much tends to drag them down again. This man, his name was Ramana Maharshi, and he lived, I think he was born maybe back in the 1920s or something like that, and he lived towards maybe up to the 1970s or something. And this little video clip I saw, black and white, was from around the 1950s or something. And he had some very powerful meditation experiences. And in this video clip, whatever it is that I saw of him, he was sitting in front of this little hut. Right? He had this little hut. It was made of concrete, four concrete walls, and on the front was a concrete porch. Right? And normally he would be sitting on that concrete porch, and then on that, no paint, just pure concrete. And then from the ceiling would be one of those lights, right? One of those bare cables coming down from the ceiling with a bare bulb glaring this kind of really unpleasant white light coming off it, like one of those kind of proverbial prison cells that are really bad, right? That's a bit like what it looked like. And then this man, in this kind of really what people would call harsh environment of concrete and harsh light, etc., this man, he would just sit there, and he was completely naked apart from a loincloth. Apart from that, he had nothing. And he would just sit there, and he would sit there, and he would sit there, and he would hardly ever move, day after day, week after week, year after year, right? And he would always look incredibly peaceful, incredibly happy, incredibly content. And every now and again, he would open his mouth and he would give some words of advice to the people around him. But most of the time, he would just sit there being completely happy. He was the picture of somebody who had no aims and purposes in life whatsoever. There was nothing at all driving him anymore. He was completely happy just to be sitting down and doing nothing. And that to me, in a sense, is almost like the picture of the awakened person. I don't know if he was awakened. You don't have to go that far to be like that. But he had something very special. That is the picture of somebody who's completely awakened. We have given up all the purposes, all the drives, all the things that pushes you around in the world. And you're completely content and satisfied in the present moment. It's a very beautiful thing, right? No more restlessness. No more agitation. No more willpower driving you forward. Just a sense of final completion and satisfaction in life. Just bliss and nothing else. There's nothing else to be done. You have reached the goal that craving said you would reach if you followed the craving. But you have reached it by precisely not following the craving and looking in a different direction instead. So again, right? Purposes and aims. How important are they? They are the things that make us human in many ways. It's a very important part of human or animal life or any kind of life. But in the end, they are a problem. They are something that we're not really useful to us. Actually, they cause problems to us. So in this sense, you could say that in one way, that machine is probably far more happy than sitting there doing zeros and ones, right? Binary code, adding things up or subtracting whatever it's doing. Than sometimes we are as human beings. It's kind of counterintuitive, but it shows you a little bit about this Buddhist path and the path of meditation practice. But the story of the machines, the story of the robots and artificial intelligence, it doesn't stop with the idea of aims and purposes. It goes way beyond that. Because one of the questions that we were discussing at this global conference that we had a year and a half ago was the question, is it possible for consciousness to actually arise in the machine? Can a machine become aware? Can machine have experiences just like we have experiences, right? Seeing, hearing, all these kind of things. Is that possible for a machine? Of course, if a machine can have consciousness, that means it will start to feel things. And once it has consciousness and it feels things, then of course, all those aims and purposes again, they come back into the equation again. They become part and parcel of what that machine is. So is it possible for a machine to become conscious? It's an interesting question, and it's not one that is very easy to answer. But again, go back to Buddhist philosophy. What does Buddhism have to say about this? Actually, before I say that, I should say that one of the kind of modern ideas about how machines become conscious is very simple, that if you create something that is complex enough, right, something like a brain or something like a computer circuitry, which is so complex that kind of all of these bits interact in a certain pattern, then consciousness kind of pops up on top of that, right? This is one of the ideas that people have about consciousness in the world. This is what some philosophers are philosophizing. Of course, when I look at that, I think, you just make it complex and then consciousness pops up. That sounds like magic to me. Why should consciousness pop up just because you're making something very complex? Is there any connection? Why is there a connection between complexity and awareness? It's just a philosophy. It's just an idea. There is really no proof behind that. And I think it's a very poorly poor idea myself. It doesn't really make much sense. So instead of looking at it that way, what is the Buddhist idea behind this? And the Buddhist idea is that consciousness can only exist when there are certain causes and conditions come into place. Without those causes and conditions, consciousness cannot actually exist. This is one of those basic teachings of the Buddha. So even the mind can only exist when there are certain causes and conditions. And one of the main causes and conditions for the existence of the mind, and this is what you find in the Buddhist famous teaching of dependent origination, consciousness arises as a consequence of will. Right? The doer inside of you. If you like, even the craving. Craving is very closely related to the will. So when you have will, that is when consciousness arises. And the will in turn comes from delusion, from our lack of understanding of the world. So how does this work? It sounds kind of weird, right? Okay, you have delusion. From delusion comes the will. From will comes consciousness. This seems like very disjointed. So I'll explain to you briefly what's going on here. And what is going on here is that the will to act, craving, the idea that we can do stuff in the world, comes from our personal idea that we are actors in the world that can make a difference in our life. The idea that we understand happiness and suffering, and because we understand that and we are actors who have power over these things, because of that, we start acting. Will comes into existence because we think that we have agency over happiness and suffering in the world. So if we misunderstand happiness and suffering, as I was just saying before, with the idea of always running after craving, never really coming to the conclusion, right? It means that will is based on a delusion. Right? From delusion comes the will. If we understood the world as it actually is, we realize that the will actually has no place in this whole scheme of actually creating happiness and suffering. The less will you have, the more peaceful you feel, and the more happiness you have. It's very counterintuitive, but that's actually how it works. Delusion gives rise to the will. And then the will, the idea with will here, is that whenever you want something, whenever you will something, it feels like you are making a choice. Right? You are making a choice. You say, I want ice cream, I don't want carrots. Right? Give me ice cream rather than carrots. So I want to see, you know, cowboy movies, not kind of romantic movies wherever it is. So you have this will, and every time you make a choice, whatever that is, and very often it has to do with how we deal with the people around us, when we make a choice, we have to be the owners of that choice, because it feels like we are doing it. Right? So when it feels like you are doing it, because then you become the owner of the choices you make. And because you become the owner, if you make a bad choice, you feel bad about it afterwards. If you make a good choice, you feel good about it afterwards, because you are the owner of what you did. It is yourself that actually made that choice and willed accordingly. Right? So when you will things, you are affecting your mind. The more good things you do in life, positive, saying kind things to others, doing little kinds of acts of charity, doing little acts of kindness, thinking thoughts of compassion. Every time you do that, because you are the owner of that act, you are lifting yourself up. You feel better about yourself. And this is how we affect our mind through our actions. This is the basic idea of how this idea of karma works in Buddhism. Right? Karma is that when we act, it has an outcome in either pleasure or displeasure. This is how it works. You are the owner of your actions. When you act, when you will, you affect your mind. If you do bad things, you think back, oh no, I did bad things. You judge yourself badly. You have no choice. You have to judge yourself badly to some extent. And by doing that, you bring your mind down. You make your mind into a slightly darker and more unpleasant place. And you bring it down. So your consciousness is affected by how you live your life. You can either lift yourself up, or you can bring that consciousness down to a lower level. This is how the will affects consciousness. But there's even one other way, which is even more profound than that. And that is the fact that for consciousness to exist at all, there has to be will there. There has to be craving here. Because that will, that craving, is what projects the consciousness into the future here. What I'm talking about here is the Buddhist idea of rebirth, right? If you die, and if you have no more desire, no more craving, no more will, no more projection into the future, then when you die, it's all over here. Right? The end of suffering has arrived. The highest happiness has come to you. But if you still have craving at the point when you die, if you still want to exist, if you still want to enjoy the things in the world, that craving is going to project the consciousness into the future again. So the very existence of consciousness and the level of consciousness, whatever that level is dependent on your will. The will is what drives it. Right? This is the Buddhist idea of how this arises. This is how consciousness comes into being. Right? And what you can see here, when you look at this carefully, of course, will always comes with consciousness itself. You can't will anything without consciousness, right? A computer doesn't really have will, it just performs calculations. Consciousness and will must go together. Delusion and consciousness must go together. Something has to be deluded. Only consciousness can be deluded. So in a way, what's happening here is that consciousness leads to more consciousness. Only from a basis of consciousness in the past will you get more consciousness in the future via the agency of the will. I apologize if I'm kind of really saying things. I know this is probably tough for a Friday night, right? Finally, you want to come here to just relax and hear some nice teachings. And you get this crazy monk talking about all these things. Oh, I get a headache from all of this. For me, it seems straightforward because I've been doing this for so long. So I apologize for getting too dry here. But in a way, it's very interesting, actually. So for those of you who are feeling interest in this kind of things, maybe you enjoy it after all. From consciousness comes more consciousness. Right? Robot, the idea that suddenly by making something complex enough, suddenly consciousness will pop out on top is impossible from Buddhism because that consciousness has to come from a prior consciousness that lies beforehand. But here it is saying that all you have to do is create this complex machine, and from that complex machine, consciousness arises as a consequence. It cannot happen, right? Because the prior element of will and consciousness is not there. So again, we don't have to worry so much about these machines. We don't have to worry about them becoming conscious, at least not in this way. From a Buddhist point of view, everything I'm saying here, of course, is from the Buddhist point of view. That's really all that interests me, at least for tonight. So again, there is no problem there. But there is one last possibility, right? So this, now we have looked at, okay, no robots, pure machines cannot have any will, they cannot have any purpose, any aim in life. Consciousness cannot just rise out of nothing, right? Complexity from a Buddhist point of view. What about, this is the last possibility, what about if somebody gets reborn as a robot? Right? That's the possibility we haven't considered yet. Is that possible? Could you get reborn as a robot? I think there are a few ways that might happen. But one of them might be that somebody creates a robot, right? This robot machine, this physical thing. And this physical thing, in a sense, has all the abilities that human beings have in experiencing the world. It has the ability of touch, perhaps, the ability of sight with cameras. It has kind of metal ears. It can hear something, right? And this kind of stuff. And as long as that body has the ability to give you experiences in the same way as a human body has, maybe you can get reborn as a robot. You can get reborn into this metal skeleton, right? And I'm sure that there are people out there, because people sometimes get really hooked on technology and things. I'm sure there are people out there who would give lots of money to be reborn as a robot. They would actually want that, right? Whoa, that would be cool. I'd be so strong and powerful. I would be indestructible. I would live for 1,000 years, right? Just change a few spare parts here, spare parts there. Get some good parts, titanium, not just ordinary steel, right? Whoa. I'm sure there are people like that. And as long as somebody out there, I think it's complete madness to want to be reborn as a robot. I can't even imagine what that would be like. But I'm sure there are people like that. So if you have that craving, right? Somebody has built a machine. Before you know it, bang, you find yourself reborn as a robot. And if it isn't possible in human existence, I can imagine that there are other types of existences, like the robot realm, right? And because one of the ideas of Buddhism is that you can be reborn with a mind-made body. So you create your own robot with your mind, and you get reborn into the realm of robots. I think one of the things which is interesting, of course, is very often, where do all these ideas come from anyway? Ideas of robots, of, you know, all these machines and this kind of things, where does it actually arise from? And sometimes I think it may arise from memories that we may have from perhaps a past existence where these things actually existed. But anyway, I'm getting a bit sidetracked again. So imagine that we actually, a consciousness, somebody gets reborn as a robot. What would happen then? Right? Somebody gets reborn as a robot. What would happen then? And what is interesting, I think, what would happen then is that because it is a being, a human being, that essentially is moving on from an ordinary life to a robot, this robot would be no different from us. Right? It would be just like us. It would have desires. It would have cravings. It want to have nice relationship. Mr. Robot wants to meet Mrs. Robot, right? You have a nice relationship with each other. There are certain things they don't want to do. You think that finally I've got this nice robot in my house that can do the dishes. And the robot says, no, I don't want to do dishes. It's so boring. Right? So you get this nice robot that finally is going to help you out. But because it is a human robot, has no interest in doing those human things anymore. And then Mr. and Mrs. Robot, they come to Ajahn Brahm and say, oh, we are having relationship problems, right? Ajahn Brahm would say, go to the robot relationship therapist, not come to me, I have enough problems already. Actually, he probably won't say that, because they will probably say, oh, but we are Buddhist robots, right? We practice in the five precepts. Please, please help us. So we can also kind of, you know, sort out our emotional, robot emotional problems. So the point is that if a robot ever were to acquire consciousness, it would be exactly like us. It would be sensitive. It would have feelings. It would want to get into relationships. It would crave for fame. It would be kind of, if you told the robot, go to war. This is one of the most scary scenarios, is robots for war, right? The robot said, no, don't want to go to war. I don't want to die. Somebody might blow me up. That's the whole point. You have a metal body. You're supposed to get blown up. No, but I feel, right, just like you. Don't send me to war. Right? You can see the whole idea of what a robot is collapses. It doesn't make any sense anymore. We wouldn't even want those robots, right? It's difficult enough to deal with ordinary people. Now you have to deal with a robot who has feelings, for goodness sake. Enough of that. If you're going to have a robot, keep consciousness out of it. So we can, you know, we can boss it around and tell it, do the dishes now, and it won't complain about doing the dishes. Now do the vacuuming. Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am. I will do the vacuuming. Do, do, do. That's the kind of robot we want in our lives. So for goodness sake, let's keep consciousness out of the robots. Get consciousness in there. It's going to mess up the whole benefit of having these kind of beings. So, that purpose of the talk tonight, you may wonder what that is. The purpose of the talk tonight is simply just to understand what it is to be human, what it is to be conscious, how consciousness arises, and also to look at some of these scare scenarios you sometimes see when you see movies, when you see films. Are they really realistic? From a Buddhist perspective, does it make any sense to look at the world in this way? Instead, think of conscious robots as our friends, right? Beings that are just like us, they have consciousness, and a robot becomes very unscary when the robot says, oh, I don't want to do the dishes, right? Please leave me alone. I just want to relax in front of the TV just like you, right? Chill out, play computer games or whatever. Then it kind of takes away some of that edge of robots. So there you are. That is my talk for this evening here. Okay, so, please. Very good. Thank you so much. Okay, so anybody have any questions? We'll take it from here before we go overseas. Drew, okay. Oh, please don't make it too difficult, Drew. Yeah.
Put up my own speaker. I was just wondering, Ajahn, you said that if you have feelings, then you have the will to live, and that drives life. So I can see how that obviously works for humans and animals. But then, does that mean plants have some sort of level of consciousness, because they obviously have a will to live because they grow through the forest, and they obviously experience pain from heat and frost, and you can see which way they grow if there's too much heat or frost. So how does that fit into the scheme you've described?
Yeah, that's a good question. That's fine. It's an important question, I think. A lot of people in certain traditions will say that plants have certain feelings, right? If you cut them, they say, ow, ouch, don't cut me, right? That kind of stuff. But from a Buddhist point of view, plants don't actually have consciousness, even a rudimentary consciousness. So from a Buddhist point of view, it's just an automatic process. It's like you are, you know, you have they have genes, right? Plants have genes. They have a genetic code which kind of programs them to do certain things. And they're, in a sense, following a program, just like a computer is following a program and executing that program. And that is what gives them a sense of purpose. But they're just running, I think, a program rather than actually having any experience of what is going on. That would be my take on the Buddhist understanding of plants. Okay, somebody at the back there has a question.
What is your view on pest control and ant management on the backyard? Rat control measures.
Rat control.
And pest as well, you know, pest control.
Okay.
What's your view on...
Okay. Pest control and rat control. Okay, so kind of vermin control or whatever, right? Okay, so my view on that is that basically, we all know the five precepts, right? Not to kill any animals. So most of those pests, they are animals. And they have little feelings in them saying, no, please don't kill me, I want to live as well, right? And this is something that is still, I think, very at the beginning stages, especially in Western society, to understand that even insects might have feelings. It's taken a long time for Western society to catch up with Buddhist ideas. Buddhism has been saying all along that animals have feelings. So in Western society, kind of mostly to do with, I think, kind of the Western philosophy and that sort of stuff, has been that humans has been the only conscious beings around. Animals, they're like machines. And gradually we become to understand that animals also have consciousness. And now, very recently, I read an article. The article was, but what about if insects have consciousness, right? What are we going to do then? We're going to be in serious trouble because we rely on killing so many insects in the world. And so this is a serious problem. So what it means in practice, first of all, it means that you minimize killing in your own life as far as you possibly can, right? This is really the beginning of things. I don't kill mosquitoes at all. I haven't done that for 20 years now. And after a while, you get into a mind frame where even not killing one of the most irritating insects around, right? You're lying at night in your room and you hear a mosquito buzzing. You know that feeling? You're lying in your bed trying to fall asleep and the mosquito is buzzing. There's no way you're going to fall asleep, right, when the mosquito is buzzing in there. It makes it so much harder to fall asleep. And just because of this little prick, little kind of sucking blood a little bit, and you get so scared of that. So you change your attitude, and you kind of anthropomorphize that mosquito a little bit. You remember that a mosquito, in many ways, is like us. And you can change your attitude to the mosquito, have a sense of compassion for that mosquito instead. And this, I think, is the basis for how to deal with pest control, how to deal with vermin control, to remember that all of these beings, they have feelings. They're not robots, not a computer, you can just smash it and it doesn't make any difference. They actually have feelings. So when you do that, it means that you are far more careful. And you, if there is an absolute necessary to control vermin or insects, then occasionally you might do it because it is legally necessary or something like that. Sometimes there may be no choice. If there is absolutely no choice, you do it with a sense of regret, but you still do it. But if there is a way out of it, you try to find the way out of it first. So that is the right attitude with these things. You avoid as far as you can, and then if you cannot avoid, well then, sometimes, regrettably, you have to do this kind of thing. So, and what that means is that it means many things, but one of the things it means, remember that karma, karma in Buddhism is a very complex kind of thing. Yeah? And one of the things about karma is that it depends on your motivation, right? What is your motivation when you are killing something? Yeah? There are many ways we can kill things. We can kill things out of hatred. Yeah? We can kill things out of desire. I hate cockroaches. And you take your shoe and you bang, you smash the cockroach. That is bad karma because it's coming from a very unwholesome state of mind. But if you say, I have no choice, I am compelled to do this because of the health regulations or whatever it is, to do this, then the karma involved is also much less because you're doing it knowing that it is the wrong thing to do. Ideally, you would avoid it. You have compassion for the beings when you do it. You're not coming from hatred, but you're in a very difficult situation where you have to do that. The karma in that case is far, far less severe than it is if you're coming from a bad motive. Right? Is it making sense what I'm saying? Yeah? So this is how you judge these things. And then when you judge these things in this way, then you are kind of finding a suitable balance in these issues. Okay. So, yes, over here.
Ajahn, you're saying how arahants would move towards a state of no desire, no craving.
Yeah.
Where does compassion fall in? So if you have a desire to save someone's life or help people.
Yeah.
I remember the story of the Buddha. He tried to, I don't, correct me if I'm wrong, but he tried to prevent an army from destroying his kingdom, former kingdom, multiple times, and he failed, and he, I don't know if he felt upset or not, but where does compassion fall in? Is that different?
Sure.
To ordinary craving, desire?
It's a good question, and the answer to that is it's very much what I was talking about. Remember I was saying that will leads to consciousness, right? So will is the doer, the agent inside of you. It is the same thing as... it's basically will, but the point about will is that will is driven by something. Will doesn't happen just by itself. Will is driven by motivations. And it is the motivation that gives the ethical significance to the will. Right? Kamma, action, is will. Basically, that's what it says in the sutras. Chetana aham kammang vadami, says the Buddha, which means, I say kamma is actually will. Will is what I call kamma. So whenever you will something, you're making kamma. But that will, in turn, is based on what is your motivation. So what is your motivation when you do something? Sometimes we do things out of anger, right? We say something harsh to somebody. Sometimes we say something out of desire because we want to get something. Sometimes we speak out of compassion. And that is where compassion comes in. Compassion is one of the motivating forces that drive us in the world to do things. And as such, it is a beautiful motivating force. So when you do something out of compassion, that is the driving force, you are making good karma by definition in Buddhism. So this is one of those crucial things. If you want to understand whether you are practicing the right way, heading in the right way, you should always ask yourself the simple question, what is driving me in this case? What is motivating me here? And that is where you know whether you are actually doing the right thing or not. Compassion is good, right? Kindness is good. Metta is good. Understanding is good. Peace is good. These are the good things. Hatred, not very good, right? Anger, pretty bad. Sense all kind of pleasures. I want to get greed, right? Not very good. Delusion, blindness, you feel confused and all that kind of stuff. Not so good either. Huh? So this is how you classify actions into good ones and bad ones. Okay. Okay. Anyone else? Everybody happy? Yeah? Oh, over there. Okay. Very good.
I agree about not killing insects.
Yeah, great. You've gone a long way already on the path. That's really good, actually. Not many people agree with that. Okay, great. Yeah.
What's your view about white ants on roofs?
White ants on roofs? Again, it's one of those things, right? Very, very difficult situations because the white ants may destroy the building unless you do something about it. So you try to find a solution to those things. The best thing to do is to make sure you have some do some measures beforehand, which stop the white ants from getting in there. You use some white ant mesh, right? Or you kind of spray the ground before they even arrive, so they can't really get through that chemical barrier, whatever. But sometimes, I think you're right, sometimes if your house, for goodness sake, is threatened by white ants, sometimes you haven't got much choice, right? You say, I really don't want to do this. I have thought about every possible solution. I don't know what to do. And maybe sometimes that is the only solution you can do. I don't know. I'm not sure. I'm not no expert in these things. But maybe that is the only solution. And when you do it in that way, you think carefully about it. You kind of measure up what the possibilities are. You also minimize the bad effect both on the animals and on yourself for doing it. Oi, and over here as well. Okay.
Can I say something, Ajahn Brahmali?
But hold on a second, Eddie. What was one over here, first of all? Yeah. One over here, in the middle here, of the floor. Yeah.
Hello, Ajahn. Oh, is it on?
Yeah.
You were saying that compassion is a good motivator and that greed is a bad motivator, but just wondering about sense of purpose.
Yeah.
Or having a passion for something, if that where that would come on the spectrum.
Okay.
For motivation.
Okay, so sense of passion for something. Yeah. So this is one of those things that, you know, people often focus a lot on in life, is what should I do with my life, right? I have a passion for some things, I like something, I dislike other things. Passion is just a very strong sense of calling for something, a sense of liking a certain thing, yeah. And that is often very good, because if you have a passion for something, it means that it's easier to enjoy it, right? And if you enjoy things, it's easier to be kind and do the good things in the world. So I think having a passion for things is generally good. But remember that it's not what we do in life that really matters at the end of the day. It's not whether you are a CEO of a company, or you are a street sweeper, or whatever else it is in between. That's not really the important issue. It's not what we do that matters. It's how we live that actually matters. So if you are a kind and compassionate a street sweeper, the kind of the most lowly job perhaps in society sometimes, but you are a bad CEO, you're probably far better off doing that job on the bottom of the scale, right? You have a bright future, but the CEO, who may be very powerful now, has a very dismal future because of the way they're living their life. So it is not, passion is great because it makes it more fun to do what you're doing. But in the end, it's how you actually do your job. Do your job with kindness. Do your job thinking about the customer, right? How can I be kind to the customer? How can I be kind to my coworkers? How can I do something positive to help the world forward? With that kind of attitude, you're making your world into something powerful in your life and help to lift you up and make you a better person. Yeah. Okay. Okay, Eddie, you want to say something? Yeah.
Ajahn Brahmali, you know, we human beings, we can be compared to robots too, you know, or just thinking, you know, okay. See, robots, the human beings feed them data and they work according to what's been fed, isn't it? For us human beings, we are fed by the good and bad thoughts, you know, energies.
Yeah.
You know, so we act accordingly to this, like a good or bad forces influencing us.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
So you're saying that when we make robots, we should make a program, dumber program inside of them, right? That we're saying. Okay. Good idea. Good point. Yeah.
So ultimately, it would be like to free ourselves, you know, from the suffering. It would be like say in religions, like Hinduism, we have Atman, one with God. You know.
Yeah.
You know, So in Buddhism, we have Samadhi. You know, one pointedness is, you know, or nirvana, when you extinguish all those negative things, you know, and then, or when we are not immune to all these, how do I say, thoughts of fear, you know, anger and all these things.
Yeah.
And then that's the peace, you know.
That's right, yeah. Good, yeah.
That's the ultimate things, isn't it?
Good, isn't it? Yeah.
Sorry.
Excellent. Good, okay. She's summarizing the whole talk there for me. That's really good of you. Okay, so let's take these questions from overseas. So this is from Adam in the USA. So Adam's asked this question. Could robots become a vehicle for reincarnation? A new home for will and desire? Well, that's exactly what I was saying, right? You must have asked this question early on during the talk and sent it through. So I think I've already answered that. Whether it actually is possible or not, I don't know. It is speculation on my part, right? When I say that it might be possible, but I can't really see any reason why that might not be possible, because it's just that process going on of desire and craving here. Okay, next one. This is from Wolfram in Germany. Can you not enjoy the pleasures of life if you do not get attached and crave for more? Just enjoy and let go. Okay, so I would recommend you to just investigate a little bit and just feel what the pleasures of life, what they feel like. And what you will find is that the ordinary pleasures of life, they are inherently caught up with craving and desire, because they always tend to lie in the future somewhere, always lie somewhere else. Of course, if you start developing your mind in a kind of Buddhist way, in a spiritual way, by becoming more kind and compassionate, it tends to have affect the ordinary happinesses as well, right? The ordinary pleasures in life tend to become more important, more powerful. There's less craving and desire involved with them. But there's always a certain degree of craving and desire involved with those pleasures in life. There's always a certain pursuit, a certain aim and objective involved with those. You can make it less, but you can't actually delete it completely. The only kind of happiness where there's no craving and desire involved is the happiness that is directly in the present moment. When you sit down and you feel good about your life because you're living well, that is a happiness you have right here and now. It's not something which is looking forward to something in the future at all. It's a very different type of happiness. So notice that. Try to just analyze in your own life the different type of happinesses you can feel. And you will see that there is a clear difference there between those happinesses. And the spiritual happiness is the only one that really can exist fully in the present moment. And of course, this is what samadhi, deep meditation, is ultimately about. Pure happiness, purely in the present moment. No past, no future. Just blissing out moment after moment. At that point, all craving and desire has disappeared. There's no more aim and purpose in life. And at that point, you're experiencing the highest happiness you've ever had in your entire life. And you realize part of that is because craving and desire has stopped. Okay, this is from Bill in Brisbane. Hello Bill, groups of people meditating have lowered the crime rates in that area as a result of their meditation. Okay, that's pretty good. How does this happen? What changes, what force is being activated to create this change? Okay, so groups of people meditating have lowered the crime rates in the area as a result of the meditation. How does this happen? And maybe happens in many, many different ways. And I think some of the ways are probably more obvious than the other ones. But I guess even if you just have some people who become more kind and more compassionate, right? One of the ideas of meditation is to make you a more kind and compassionate person. Even if you just have one group of people who walk out in society and they're more kind and compassionate in society around them, that already probably will have a little bit of influence, right? Probably be working on that level already here. But it may also be, I think it's also quite possible, that there will be a general just feeling in that society which will actually be better. When people are more kind, it just feels better, right? I know whenever I come back to the monastery, Bodhinyana Monastery, I walk through the gate, especially when there's nobody there, it's very peaceful and very beautiful. When I walk into the meditation hall, it is very, very when there's nobody around, again, very beautiful atmosphere in there. It's like a power of peace, in a sense. We had some examples of people coming to Bodhinyana Monastery. Some of them people who are very ordinary people from, you know, ordinary walks of life. People like concrete layers, right? Big, really big blokes, right? Full of concrete and boots and everything, right? And quite rough in their manner, all of these kind of things. But, you know, very nice and good people regardless. And they come into that hall and they say, wow, this is really nice. This is something you feel. If you are in the right mind state, you can feel these feelings. Anybody can feel that. And I think maybe this is also one of the things that we do here as well. We are creating an atmosphere in here at the Maloka Center, which reverberates outside of the center and probably affects the whole region around here to some extent. Depending on the sensitivity of the people who are around here, you can often feel that. I don't know, when I sit here and meditate on a Friday night, I feel it's very nice. I feel the vibe here is quite good, right? It feels good. It feels like you're in good company, that you have kind of good people around you. It puts you in a kind of right atmosphere. And I think this is one of the reasons why people like to come here, because it's helpful to be in the right company when you want to do meditation practice. So something like that. I cannot really say with absolute certainty why these things happen, but that would be my guesswork. So, that is all for tonight. Let's just pay respect to the Buddha-Dhamma Sangha.
Patipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sanghang Namami.